Hi, friends. Welcome back in to Flourish FM and our special series on anti-fragility. Today, I sat down with Josh Hernandez. I've known Josh for a few years at this point. Really, really incredible, humble, kind-hearted guy. Also highly successful in a variety of different areas that he's chosen to take on. Josh, early on, had kind of an academic career in exercise physiology and athletic training. That quickly had to change due to some unforeseen circumstances that led him to then think about medical school. That then had to change to help his family run a trucking company in El Paso, Texas, which he built up and has now successfully exited. Aside from that, Josh is an entrepreneur. He's got a lot of different projects going on, and he is a devoted and loving father of three, as well as a, I think, significantly contributing member of the El Paso community. The conversation with Josh took us to some really interesting places. Obviously, we talked a lot about well-being and resilience and performance, but what Josh discussed really was, I think, more of a we approach or endeavor philosophy about anti-fragility, more so than a me. He talked a lot about the examples that were set for him by parents, friends, loved ones growing up, even now in adulthood. Talked a lot about setting examples for his kids, leaning on others in times of challenge and difficulty, and to be adaptable in the face of adversity as you interact with those communities. Keep faith, purpose, meaning front and central, and really try to dig in and have integrity in how you interact with other people. So it was a great take, I think, and perspective on some of these topics we've been digging into. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Josh Hernandez.
Hey, what's going on, Nick?
Good morning, my man. How you doing?
All right, and yourself?
I'm doing all right, thanks. Good to connect with you. Glad we're doing this. All right, so let's dive right in. Topic at hand, anti-fragility. I thought the way we might start this out, Josh, is I'll lay out for you sort of the way we're conceptualizing anti-fragility, what we're hearing from different researchers, how we break it down, and then I'd love to kind of dig into your life and your history and explore that topic or those subtopics, you know, kind of through your lived experience. And so what that looks like here is thriving, right, in the face of, or really because of, adversity. That might be chaos, that might be ambiguity, that might be just general unpleasant experiences, whatever it might be. But it's a step beyond resilience. We're not just talking about bouncing back from hard stuff. We're actually talking about growing and becoming better or stronger or however you want to talk about it, right? We are growing because of that adversity. That's kind of how we're thinking about anti-fragility, right? And so we'll break that down into three basic buckets. The resilience piece, the ability to at least bounce back, if not go beyond it, right? So in other words, navigating the unpleasant or the negative, if you will, air quotes, the bad, well-being, building the good, and performance, thinking about how you perform. And we don't necessarily mean productivity, but like in the things you care about on a day-to-day basis, right? So how do you build the good, navigate the bad, for lack of better or stronger language at this point, and perform optimally day-to-day, right? So does that conceptualization resonate? Is that how you're coming in thinking about anti-fragility?
Yes, sir. I was initially introduced to the concept by, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but Nassim Taleb.
You got it. Nicholas Nassim Taleb. Yep.
Or Taleb. Yes, sir. And I was introduced to that concept by him, and I read his book, and that's kind of like when I first became interested in anti-fragility and the whole Hydra concept where you cut off the head, but it comes back with more heads.
Yeah,
and
perfect.
After utilizing that or reading about that concept, I tried to implement it in different areas of my life as right. well.
Where are some of the areas of life? Let's start there that you focused on trying to become more anti-fragile.
Oh, well, previously, and we'll probably get into this a little bit later, we had several businesses. And after reading that book, it was talking about having more margin. Also trying to, I guess, have more margin and as well as having redundancy. So that way, if people go down, you have other people to take their place. And you may be a little bit weaker, but then you come back stronger. The other thing was, I just had a conversation with another business owner. They're kind of struggling right now, but they've been burnt in the past by hiring bad salespeople. But right now, like, it's slow for them. And my recommendation to them was to hire more sales reps. So that way they could start playing some more offense. Like if it was my business, I would have played offense several months ago, just so that way I wouldn't be playing catch up. But it's always trying to prevent from playing catch up, but just get ahead of the game.
Yeah, it's proactive. Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, that last piece you said there, get ahead of the game, but sort of proactively preparing for when things might go wrong, right? That's an element or an application of anti-fragility for you, right? Which makes good sense.
And regarding business, it's all about cash flow. And for us, it's always having those reserves, never over-leveraging ourselves, some concepts like that to make sure that even if we did survive, even though we went through hard times, we could still survive those hard times, similar to the 2008 financial crisis.
Sure. So I'm curious then, and maybe here's our entry point into your, I think, your very interesting history and story, and your parents as well, for that matter, which maybe we'll get into. This proactive plan for the bad, be prepared sort of approach, is that always been sort of how you operated? Was it really an introduction to a term like anti-fragility that nudged you to do it more intentionally or strategically? Or do you think you've built up that sort of tendency throughout the course of a lifetime?
It's more building up the skill over a lifetime. And for me, back to the whole anti-fragility concept, when you asked me to, when you said you wanted to talk about it, I kept asking myself, why me? I don't feel like I'm anti-fragile. And after thinking about it, the reason I did this was to actually honor the people who, in my life, who have exhibited anti-fragility. And one of my best friends, him and his wife lost a child, a three-year-old daughter, many years ago. And the statistics on losing a child and being in a marriage is, and the marriage surviving is like less than 10%. But they've been able to thrive after that incident and raise three beautiful children who I consider like nieces and nephews. And they're actually my mentors when it comes to marriage. They're my marriage best friends, if that makes any sense. They're the relationships I want to impact. Now, also, my sister has dyslexia. And 30, 40 years ago, dyslexia, there was no education for that. And the fact that she's able to thrive with, been able to survive and thrive throughout that has been, like, now that I'm older, I respect her more because of that. And one last person that I also want to honor is my friend David and his wife, Belinda. I've known him since high school, but he got this really serious medical condition. And it's like one in a million disease. Boy, he got it. And over the past couple of years, I've been watching them adjust to this medical condition, which has debilitated him in a lot of ways, but her supporting him through that situation and them coming back stronger. So I spoke to all of them about this to share their stories and to tell them, hey, I would like to honor you about that. Because my life doesn't seem anything compared to everybody else's. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It makes sense, I think. And this is one of the reasons why I've always liked you. You're selling yourself short. You're a humble guy by nature. That said, it makes sense. I appreciate you honoring their stories. And I think that's a good thing to include, because part of the reason why we're doing this kind of sub-series and focusing on it is the topic or the idea comes up time and time again. It seems to resonate. And I think it seems to resonate because a lot of people do have this sort of lived experience or see it through friends, family, whatever it might be. And I think that's potentially a really good segue, because my sense is of your upbringing and your parents' story, which I'd love you to just walk us through a little bit, that you started witnessing this, if not living it yourself, at a pretty young age.
Yes, sir. My parents were teenage parents. My mom was 16. My dad was 17, about ready to be 18 when I was born. And both of their parents, and then my mom was adopted as well. So there's some dynamics regarding that as well.
Had they immigrated as well?
No, we're actually multiple generations here in the U.S. and whatnot.
Okay. All right. So where were you at this time? New Mexico?
Oh, we were in El Paso.
You were in El Paso.
Okay. El Paso, Texas. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
And my dad joined the military to help provide for our family. He did it for several years, came back and got into the trucking industry because his grandfather and his dad were both truckers. So my grandfather and my great grandfather were truckers. Recently, when he did the DNA test or the ancestry.com, we found out my great great grandfather. So his great grandfather was a trucker during the Great Depression.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah. I was fifth generation in the trucking industry until we sold the companies. So he decided to go work as a truck driver and then eventually moved into management and then moved into sales and then became a trucking company owner and then went back to work for somebody else. And on September 11, 2001, 2 hours after the towers fell, that company laid him off. And he had a choice, like, what am I going to do next? One of his friends lifted him up off the ground and said, you know what? You go ahead and buy a truck and then you can lease your truck on with me and become an owner operator. And that's how the company of Mustang Express started, which we sold this past May after 20 some odd years. The thing with my mom is she's always been an entrepreneur. So since she was about 20, she had a home daycare and she built up her home daycare and had consistent, reliable business for many, many years until she came on board. And we'll get into that right now. When I got accepted into medical school and she came on board to kind of replace me and she had to close down her daycare. So, but she's always shown resilience regarding business and how to do different things. So they're another example of people I modeled myself after.
What do you think you saw in them, even at an early age, you know, in terms of characteristics or tendencies that, you know, maybe you were conscious of it, maybe you were just doing, you know, what you saw kind of in their example, but sort of behaviors maybe that you started to adopt because of their example?
One of the things is my dad, when he walks into a room, like he just has one of those auras where people are afraid of him. Okay. Or they respect him and okay. Whatnot. My wife and my other people around me sometimes say, like, when people first meet me, they're very intimidated by me. But again, I'm not seeing it. And you and I, we have this interaction, so you've never experienced it, but it's just that. And then also a sense of, hey, be honest, talk about things, build relationships. My parents have had relationships over the past, like, 40 years that have been strong and extended further. Family is very important. So we have this big, humongous community that we have, and we try to nourish and get things from, and we try to provide into it. So that's the most important thing that I think I saw from them. And another thing is, this is going to play a major role into a lot of things as well, is they're very faith-driven. And we were always involved in the church. And you and I, we've talked in the past about our love for hip-hop. Back growing up, I couldn't listen to anything but Christian music. Secular music is a no-no. And this is how my
hip-hop was the forbidden fruit, per se.
Oh, forbidden fruit. And I would spend so much money on music that I would buy the Christian CDs or Christian tapes, then go to like Sam Goody or whatever the Universal Tower stores.
Yeah.
Go buy the hip-hop CDs, put them in the Christian CDs. And back at the time, it was like 15, yes. 20 bucks. That was a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Couldn't just get the single song, right?
Exactly. So that's how my mind works. It's always trying to figure out solutions to problems.
Sure. Sure. Love it. Love it. So far then, like, faith, yes, community, sir. Or we'll say social, right? And, you know, I think our longtime listeners will have heard me or John say this a couple times, but for new people, like, those are your two greatest predictors worldwide of happiness and life satisfaction, first and foremost. So on that well-being side, social connection and a sense of meaning. It doesn't necessarily have to come through faith, right, or spirituality, but some sense of meaning. And for many people, they connect to it through religion or something else very spiritual, right? So those things make good sense. Like, it sounds like there's an early foundation of things that just help you be well on a day-to-day basis. Is that a fair sort of synopsis?
Yes, sir. Definitely. What's interesting is I cannot remember the doctor. Faith has always intrigued me, but over the past, like, I guess 6 to 7 years, my faith has changed after reading the book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics. Because I had friends fighting amongst each other and whatnot regarding political stuff. And my faith was actually questioned. And once I kind of lost my faith for a while. And during that time, I wasn't in a healthy place. And I was able to, deconstruct and then reconstruct what my faith looks like now. And ever since I reconstructed it, I said, it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. It could be a different way. So ever since I reconstructed, it's helped me build back into that meaning. So I just want to offer that, share that story with you. So that way, sure, you actually knew, reinforce what you were saying, mm-hmm, in my personal, sure, experience.
Yep. That's maybe a good segue to sort of move over to your, I think, let's call it significant life events. I'm sure there are many, but you did a good job, I think, of synthesizing some of these for me, you know, in our pre-interview before we chatted here. A lot of what we might call at minimum bounce back moments, I mean, they seem to often be centered around that commitment to family and community and impact and those sorts of things, right? Things where life events or life plans had to change or sort of, you know, do a quick U-turn because of other things going on. And when you were sharing some of this with me, they came across as moments of practicing at minimum resilience, but potentially the lessons learned from some of those experiences might have reinforced the kind of further extent of that, which is anti-fragility. So I wonder if you just walk the listeners through some of, you know, these different experiences throughout, I'd say, late adolescence, college, young professional, those sorts of things, because you've done a lot, but you've also had a lot of things you wanted to do that I think you couldn't do for various reasons.
Okay. Well, I guess back to my parents being teenage parents, we grew up, I guess, we were never poor, but we were never rich. I guess we were probably lower middle class once my dad was able to get going. And I remember growing up at the time, it was like, oh, we can't afford that. We can't afford that. And what was hilarious was like 10 years later, my parents had my youngest sister and we would go to restaurants and she would like order the most expensive thing. And being the oldest, like, we can't afford that. We can't afford that. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's just growing up. We didn't have many means. It was McDonald's on Friday and that's the only time we went out to eat all week. So that kind of, we've talked about this in the past. That's kind of impacted my thoughts on money per se. But back to that, I got accepted to a medical school here in El Paso. And I went from being in the lower middle class to middle class, middle school to high school, to getting into this magnet school that had people from all over El Paso from different walks of life and different socioeconomic backgrounds. We all came together and we're kind of like the smartest of the smart. But on top of that, that magnet school was placed in a lower socioeconomic high school. So when I first went to this high school, all my friends were like, you're going to this other school, you're going to get stabbed, you're going to get shot, you're going to become part of a gang, you're going to start doing drugs, stuff like that. But I was able to interact with different people that I would never have been exposed to. And that's also modeled my life. And all those guys seeing how they've grown up and become successful adults is actually heroic to me. And I see like they came from the bottom and they started to where they're at. And I'm impressed by all of them. Anyways, meeting all these different people has allowed me to be able to interact with a lot of different people as well.
I want to get to graduating from high school in a minute, but it just stands out to me because earlier we were talking about just lived examples in many ways. And you weren't just seeing it from your parents. You were seeing it from friends and peers at a very impressionable age as well, it sounds like, whether or not you were thinking about it at the time, all these people are anti-fragile or resilient, but it sounds like you were seeing people you cared about and were connected with dealing with really hard stuff and maybe kind of implicitly learning the way they were navigating it.
Yes, sir, definitely. But back to finding solutions to problems, I love sports. I've always loved sports, but God did not gift me with athletic ability. On top of that, I was a very late bloomer. When I was a freshman in high school, entering high school, I was 4'11", 4'11", less than 100 pounds. I went to go approach a girl and she was like, hey kid, when you get out of sixth grade, you go in and call me, even though I was a freshman in high school. But being as small as I was, I knew I couldn't play sports. So I decided to join athletic training because the magnet school I went to was a medical magnet school. So I was like, oh, athletic training, I can combine sports, participate in it, as well as participated, but also do medicine as well. I went to some state competitions. I got like ranked as high as number 3 in the state for athletic training. After I graduated, I went to the University of New Mexico on an academic scholarship. And with that, I decided to join the athletic training program as well. After 1 year, I was able to get an athletic training scholarship on top of that. And everything was going well. But the problem is I've always been one of those guys that things come way too easily for me. And I never had to struggle to learn how to study. Mm. So after a year and a half, I lost my academic scholarship. And my parents told me, you know what, since you haven't been committing the time to your studies, we're not going to assist you. You have to move back to El Paso or find a way on your own. So at the time, I decided to move back to El Paso with my tail between my legs. And anytime anyone would see, I would start going to UTEP. And anytime I started seeing my friends, they're like, hey, I thought you were this big shot over at UNM working with the athletes. And I'm like, it hurt. So I decided to, hey, I'm going to learn how to study. And on top of that, I'm going to set a goal to go to medical school.
So it's just super interesting. I just want to name this real quick. My takeaway there, because obviously we're going to eventually get to parenting and implications on young people and those sorts of things. And my experience in classrooms and teaching is really similar. You just talked about really never having to struggle academically. And thus, when you finally reached this point where it was actually difficult, you didn't have some of that built-in unpleasant experience around failure, having to grit out, you know, like cramming for an exam or a test, maybe those sorts of things. And it sort of knocked you on your ass a little bit. But then in retrospect, once you did have those challenges, and granted, it sounds like obviously a pretty dramatic shift in life and all the social implications and the emotional implications. But on the back end of that, that really refined and honed study skills that and distress tolerance that would actually enhance you and carry you on at a later date.
Yes, sir. Definitely. Definitely. That it really, again, sometimes people see struggle as a bad thing, but struggle is a good thing. It works out your muscles. So, and I was ultimately able to spend a year here at UTEP and able to get that scholarship back from UNM. The academic scholarship. And I ended up graduating from there, got my GPA up super high after that point, but not study athletic training anymore. I was doing exercise science, but I had to finish up my prerequisites for medical school. My dad called me up in 2003, a few months after I had graduated, and asked me to help him with his trucking company that he had just started, the one that I referenced earlier. So I was like, you know what? I'll move back to El Paso. It'll save me some money because I can live with you guys. I can finish up my prerequisites for medical school and then help you out at the same time. Well, I'll give you 2 years. That's what I told him. Well, those 2 years turned into 5 years. During that time, we started the business. I was finishing up my prerequisites for medical school as well as working on MBA and then also taking MCAT courses. And during that time, things were going pretty well. But one of the things that stood out in my mind, 2006 was a banner year, or no, 2005 was a banner year, perfect year. I traveled to Africa, had some amazing experiences in regards to business, but our financing company, the boss of the financing company came in and visited us. And he's like, you know what? You think you're hot stuff right now, but you're not going to find out if you're hot stuff until you go through a difficult time and you survive that difficult time. Then you can come back and tell me that you're a good businessman. So I was a punk kid. I was like 25 years old. I'm like, whatever. Okay, whatever. We're already doing this, what we're doing right now. I get into medical school in 2008. And this is also occurring while the great financial crisis is going on. So our business just gets destroyed. Well, first, oil prices went through the roof. And then the great financial crisis occurred. So I was in medical school trying to manage the business as well as manage medical school. That was waking up at 6 o'clock, working all day on studying and whatnot. There was a breaking point where I just decided I didn't enjoy school anymore. I've always enjoyed school and I've always enjoyed learning, but I couldn't imagine myself losing. I was 29 when I got into medical school, but by the time I was graduate, I would have already lost most of my 30s. And I'd already had freedom from the business. And I was like, you know what? Maybe medical school is not for me anymore. So I decided to drop out after one semester. What was very humbling is all my med school friends tried to talk me out of it. They were telling me that I was going to be the best doctor, but it's just not what I wanted at that time. So then I had to come back. It was kind of like going back to UTEP when I lost my academic scholarship. People were like, I thought you were going to become a doctor, blah, blah, blah. But they could never understand why I left. But regarding that, then it was just trying to make the company survive. At that same time, I also had the additional stress of my girlfriend at the time getting pregnant, who is now my wife, getting pregnant with my first son. So then the stress of, oh man, I have to provide for a child now. I have to provide for a significant other. oh, wow, how am I going to do this? And it's a great financial crisis. What happens if the company fails? How am I going to be able to provide for all my family?
Yeah, kind of a perfect storm.
A perfect storm. But we had built the foundation for the business throughout the years of like trying to do things right, trying to be on time, trying to communicate, trying to be proactive. And we take those soft skills for granted, but a lot of those companies that we worked with actually got us through that difficult time because of that reliability. And back to my parents, that's something that they were always known for, is being reliable. Mm. So back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally got through the great financial crisis. We started building and started getting stronger. Well, in the day before Thanksgiving 2013, one of our neighbor's dogs had jumped into our backyard. And I don't know how we got into our backyard, but we also had a dog. We had two dogs. And I see him in the morning. I'm like, okay, well, there's this dog here. How'd he get here? I took him to the vet who was down the street. And they were like, oh, he has a chip. We're going to contact the owner of the dog. I got the phone number for the owner of the dog. And they were supposed to come by and pick up the dog at 5 o'clock that afternoon. And again, it's Wednesday, the day after Thanksgiving. My mother-in-law was watching my son and my daughter at the time. My son was 3, just about ready to turn 4. And my daughter was 1. She's changing my daughter's diaper. Or no, my daughter was like 6 months old. I take that back, 6 months old. So my mother-in-law is changing my daughter's diaper. My 3-year-old son decides he wants to go see the dog. And he goes outside. And the dog then decides to maul him. I don't know if that's a proper word, but sorry, it's emotional. So it's still emotional 10 years later, but the dog mauls.
Apologize for? Yeah.
And gets him on the head, gets him all over the body, head and face and whatnot. My mother-in-law calls the fire department and the police and 911. They get over there. The police won't go into the backyard. So the firefighters finally arrive and they start arguing with the police. But one of the firefighters jumps over the backyard and sees my mother trying to defend my son against the dog and my dog trying to defend my son against the other dog and then trying to pull my son away from the dog. And it was just chaos. They were able to get the dog away and they were able to take my son and take him to the hospital. Then my wife shows up. They send her to the hospital. Then my wife calls me telling me that he's being sent to the hospital. Anyways, we end up spending 5 days in the hospital, 2 days in ICU because they couldn't find, he was bleeding internally, but they couldn't find the bleeding and they were able to finally take care of him. He ended up having to require surgery and stitches throughout his head and his face. And then he had bites all over his body. But to me, that's, if there's a hell, that's hell. And I guess the anger of that moment also had both. I ended up having to go to counseling after that. And I had already started counseling a little bit sooner, but I had to really do it after that because I just didn't like the person I was becoming, as well as I wanted to be an example for my kids. Like I didn't want them to be for me to be angry. Another thing is after the incident, my mother-in-law, she was the one that was there to save my son. And she had a traumatic experience. But after he was released, we're all there at the house and my son wants to go to the backyard. And she tells him, I don't want you to go to the backyard. I don't want you to get attacked by a dog again. And to me, I got so livid and angry that I came over and I'm like, no, that's his backyard. He needs to be able to not be afraid of doing anything. He needs to go out there. Come on, let's go back out there. But I just didn't want him to be afraid of anything afterwards. And prior to that, I thought you shouldn't be afraid. I was like, being afraid is a bad thing. But like you and I, we've talked over the years. It's like, no, fear is actually a good thing if you learn how to utilize it and to do stuff. But at the same time, I didn't like the feeling of fear.
It's an interesting distinction. I think it's important that you brought it up here because I think what you've done, and thank you for sharing the story with us. Obviously, you and I have talked about it before, but I know it's emotional. I appreciate you going there for the audience. You said you started, you know, counseling even before, right? The incident with the dog, you're experiencing some anger, incident with the dog, obviously very traumatic for everyone involved. I'm sure that sort of exacerbated it.
Hi friends, Nick here with just a brief interlude to share with you an update on one of our newest partnerships, with the Anti-Fragile Academy. Throughout John and I's conversations with many, if not most, of our guests, one thing has been made really clear. In order for people to flourish, thrive, experience the good life, they need to develop the capacity to not only navigate and endure, but ideally grow from the bad, grow from unpleasant experiences. That's why we're thrilled to be partnering with our newest sponsor, the Anti-Fragile Academy, an organization that I co-founded with Dr. Adam Wright, Director of Mental Performance for the Washington Nationals. At the Anti-Fragile Academy, we work with adolescent athletes, executives, and educators to help them understand some of the science, not just of optimal performance, but of well-being and anti-fragility. The ability not only to endure and bounce back from unpleasantness, but to actually come back stronger, to grow from it. Between Adam and I, we've worked with Fortune 100 companies, Inc. 300 executives, Division I programs, and elite professional athletes and Olympians from all over the world. To find out more about how you can leverage anti-fragility training, check out our website at theantifragileacademy.com.
The reason I'm kind of revisiting and highlighting these, and you just mentioned it, is what I don't hear is anti-fragility means never experiencing the negative emotions. It doesn't mean just sucking it up and pretending things are okay. It doesn't mean, you know, deluding one and oneself into thinking that we're invincible, right, to the sort of unpleasantness that comes with different things. It really comes down to how can you sit with, understand, and react to the natural sort of negative, unpleasant occurrences of life that we sometimes choose to take on and sometimes we do not choose, as obviously is the case in this scenario.
Well, I guess that's also sometimes why I don't think I'm anti-fragile, is because it's more of the temper tantrums. Like when bad stuff happens, you get upset and you're like, ah, but then the reason I can be anti-fragile is because after the temper tantrum, then I can go ahead and resolve and be like, I can try to find a solution to things.
Well, I think that's the thing, right? Is, and granted, maybe you don't want temper tantrums, right? But we're also not saying don't experience any anger,
right?
Right. To, you know, channel, I think a lot of conversations I've had with Dr. Adam Wright about this topic, it always comes back to flexibility. And I want to get into that with you a little bit more because you strike me as extremely adaptable, right? But in this case, when I use flexibility, what we're talking about is not rigidity, not I can't feel anger, I can't feel fear, I can't feel any unpleasantness, and being rigid about that, right? Like kind of this brick wall, impermeable, but actually accepting or allowing some of those feelings in, and then being flexible and malleable and agile in how we respond to them, right? In really values aligned ways. And I think that's often sort of a misunderstanding with resilience or mental toughness or anti-fragility, whatever language you want to put around navigating negative emotions. A lot of people seem to think it means I shouldn't experience them, or I shouldn't react to them, or I should be perfect and totally controlled. That's not at all what we're talking about here. And it sounds like not your personal experience either.
Oh, definitely not my personal. You can ask my wife. It's not my personal experience.
So I'm curious then, and again, I want to come back to the adaptability piece, but like in these moments, right? So take the dog, take deciding to no longer pursue medical school and to change the course of your life and work with your family in the trucking business, you know, your wife becoming pregnant the first time around, you know, the academic experience at UNM that led you to UTEP for a period of time. In these situations, did you find yourself strategically, consciously thinking about skills and ways of navigating them? Or was there just sort of a natural tendency to just adapt and figure it out? Because I'd love to explore sort of the detail, or if you will, the how-to dealing with some of those natural, normal, but nonetheless challenging experiences.
I think a lot of it deals with more just figuring it out. And the reason I'm open about counseling and everything I share is because I know it's going to help someone. So I've never been officially diagnosed with ADHD, but now that I'm a little bit older, now I'm kind of realizing, oh, hey, I've always had the symptoms and I've always like there's just things that occur. So anyways, the reason I'm bringing this up is I'm very good at very high stressful situations. And so sometimes I need to be placed in those situations. And then it's like, all right, here's a problem. Let's figure it out. And so some of those things is like, sometimes those stressful situations force me to try to figure something out. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew that something had to happen, or I had to do something to make things happen.
That sounds inherently optimistic, right? Because even before the I need to figure it out is the belief that it can be figured out, right? Well, what I don't hear is helplessness and stopping and, you know, potentially like perceiving oneself as a victim and making the problem worse. Something in you has said, I can solve this and I need to go about solving it.
I think it's more the examples of the people in front of me, or like my parents and in my community. We have a lot of our friends that are entrepreneurs as well, business owners, and you just kind of have to figure it out. There's stuff that's going to occur and they just always figured it out. And sometimes you think that your parents know it all, but no, they didn't. They just figured it out. But the other thing is the modeling. Most people sometimes don't have that model to show them, hey, you can figure it out. And that's one of the reasons why I also coach, is try to be an example for kids in my flawed state, to try to be the single parent kids who don't have a dad, show them like, hey, look, there's a good male role model and look at what he's trying to do. So that way later on, they do have a basic model.
It's really interesting because I think the first two conversations thus far, a lot of what we've explored is what we might call of like skills of self, where it's how are they thinking about their problems and challenges, right? What perspectives are they taking? What self-talk is involved? How are they taking care of their bodies and their sleep and their nutrition? All these sorts of things that help them perform or feel well or navigate resilience. Most of the stuff you're sharing, Josh, seems very social.
Oh, it's extremely social.
Right? Like the examples that you're seeing, the people that you're interacting with, the perspectives that you're gaining. And I just think it's a really cool and interesting insight. And we know one of the single best ways to respond to stress, by the way, is socially, to get or give support. And it sounds like, you correct me if I'm wrong again, but the key to a lot of your resilience or all the way to anti-fragility throughout the course of life has been getting and or giving that support in those communal or familial settings.
Definitely. And one of the things that changed my life, I don't remember who said it, but someone said, you're as sick as your darkest secret. And from there, and maybe it's also because of my ADHD, I tend to just spout out stuff and overshare, but I want to be honest with people so that way I don't have anything to hide. Like I can be honest and transparent and I can tell people, hey, I'm struggling with this. And it just makes you feel better when you have that community of support. But at the same time, a lot of people don't have that natural tendency to share. They need models on how to share, how to feel comfortable and have trust with people to share that information with.
So now you're bringing up not just the social interaction, but what I think oftentimes people would consider some of the healthiest social interaction, which is interaction that is safe enough for vulnerability to exist.
Exactly. And going back, I love to read. I love to learn stuff. And regarding that, what's the professor's name that's known for that?
For vulnerability research?
Yes.
There's a few, but Brené Brown is probably what's coming to mind. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, sir. So I'm reading that book also. There's several things where she talks about males having to be like the white knight and be perfect for their families.
Sure.
And several years ago, I was doing a men's group where men could get together and share each other's common problems, what we're doing, without women or without the wives or significant others, where we could all just be guys and just talk about things, how be honest and vulnerable with each other and build those relationships. So I was doing that a few years ago, but that was very important. That was a good year when I was doing that. But yeah, so how do I say this? The other thing is, so much of our problems in society, especially here in the United States, a lot of them has to do with the lack of community. That's my opinion anyways. Is everyone so isolated? Yeah, we're connected by our phones, but we don't have the actual connections that we used to have, whether it be church, YMCA, bowling alleys, stuff like that, to bring people together. And to me, that's something that's important now that we somehow we need to figure it out.
So well-being, resilience, anti-fragility, however we want to talk about it, for you particularly, but I think you're also making the argument, it's not a me endeavor, it's a we endeavor.
Yes, right? Sir.
So I'm curious how you take those sorts of personal lessons, but also the social, right? We would say outside in sort of impacts on well-being, resilience, anti-fragility. Do you try to intentionally talk about that, instill that in your children? Do you put them in situations where they learn that implicitly? Do you talk about it explicitly? Or is it, you know, kind of luck of the draw? And when things pop up, you help kind of guide and mentor them through it. To what extent is it accidental as a parent versus like intentional and strategic to help kind of give them the practice and equip them with some of these resources and experiences?
It's both.
Yeah.
It's both. Now that my son's 14, he's now has a different processing.
Will you just quickly say the age of all three kids?
14, 10, and today 7. It's my youngest's birthday.
So. Yeah. Shout out. Happy birthday. Yeah.
I let him know. But the 14-year-old, now I can talk to him about different things. Now he's at the concept, we're talking about different things.
Yeah.
He loves basketball and very proud of him. He made his middle eighth grade basketball team. But his coach told him the other day that he was the leader of the team and that he was named him a co-captain. He's not the best player. He's the second best player on the team, but he's the one that communicates and exhibits the best leadership out of all the kids. So now he's getting pushback because all the kids are like, blah, 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 blah. And just middle school stuff and jealousy stuff.
Sure.
But
sure,
we've been talking about that and how to respond to it, as well as how to become a better leader. But recently I've been going over the Art of War with Sun Tzu with him and breaking it down into concepts. He had a basketball game for a city league, and this one player tried to goad him into doing something. But I saw him and he was like, no, I'm not doing that. And the player turned around to the coach and was just like, okay, what do I do now? And the coach is like, he's used to another kid like playing the game that he wants to do, becoming impatient and pressing him. That's what he wanted to do. So, but the example I'm trying to share is, okay, Sun Tzu says, if you know yourself, you know what your strengths and weaknesses are, you can win basically any battle. If you know your opponent's strengths and weaknesses, but don't know your own, hey, it's a 50-50 draw. But if you know both of your strengths and weaknesses, you're going to win every time. So I had already instilled that to him like the week before. So he was like, Dad, I didn't want to play his game. I knew he was just going to blow by me. He's faster than me and quicker than me. I wanted him to come up to me and then me to be physical with him and then slow him down. And so when the kid saw that, he was just like, what do I do? The other thing is talking to him about the Bible, going like over Proverbs and the Psalms and trying to explain different concepts to him. And then also doing like meditations, Marcus Aurelius meditation, and explain, okay, try to learn how to control
Stoicism,
yourself.
Sure.
Stoicism, yes, sir.
Yeah.
So now the other example is my daughter. When she was 4, I noticed that we took her to like a reading summer camp when she was 4, like to learn the letters and whatnot. And like my wife, she's a registered nurse, so we're both educated. And we know that all our kids are very intelligent, but we took her
your
to
daughter's this reading your middle child too, correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah.
We took her to this reading thing at UTEP at 4 years old, just to kind of like help her with her reading skills. And I remember getting upset because we went to dinner afterwards and I'm like, explain to me what you just learned. What's this letter? And she couldn't tell me what that letter was. And initially I got angry about it. I'm like, you just spent 2 hours looking at these letters. What's wrong with you? And again, I'm being totally transparent. I don't want you to think I'm like this perfect.
No, parent. You're good. Yep.
What's wrong? We just, blah, blah, blah. Well, later on, I realized, you know what? My sister has dyslexia. It's genetic, or that's someone the research is showing is, or it is genetic. Well, anyways, we decided to start getting her, what's the word I'm looking for? Tested for dyslexia. But everyone kept telling us she's too young. But I kept responding to everyone, I know she's too young, but there's something different. Not that there's something wrong. There's something different. And that's what I've always stressed to her, is like, there's something different. Well, finally, when she was 6 years old, we were able to get her tested for dyslexia and ADHD. Well, she has both. So she's had to struggle. Well, we also made the mistake in kindergarten of putting her in a dual language school where she learned Spanish, but we don't speak Spanish in the house. So she's a predominantly English speaking person, or child, excuse me. Well, she struggled at that, and struggling kind of lowered her self-esteem when it came to school. So then we had to rebuild her back up. I'm very blessed because we were able to find a school that had an amazing dyslexia teacher. I can't remember what the actual term for her, interventionist, excuse me. And she loves and adores, but we were able to find her other sorts of tutoring to get her up to speed when it came to reading and comprehension.
So can I name something really quick? This is interesting. Yes, sir. And it brings up, I think, two important research terms. So when you look at, granted, somewhat limited research on anti-fragility right now, especially like in an environmental or contextual setting, the thing you'll find is language like facilitative environments and unrelenting environments. Okay. So an unrelenting environment is high challenge, low to no support. A facilitative environment, one that facilitates, right, or leads to greater growth, anti-fragility, et cetera, is high challenge, but high support. And what stood out to me about your story, about your daughter's experience, is that the struggle was not necessarily the problem, right? The problem was, and not anything to say about previous teachers or school or whatever, not having adequate support to help your daughter through that struggle and to actually grow from it. It sounds like it went from pretty unrelenting in a way that hurt ego or esteem or confidence, like you said, to one that became a bit more facilitative.
Yes, sir. Definitely. And all the teachers that she's had since, even the teachers there at that school, were very good teachers. It's a great school. It just wasn't a good school for my daughter.
Sure. Yeah. And goodness of fit.
Exactly. And the school that she goes to is a little bit smaller, so it actually works better for her as well. Yeah, so, but now she's actually meeting and exceeding the qualifications for reading. So there's another example of anti-fragility.
Do you see changes in her behaviors or tendencies that you're really proud to see, you think, as a result of those struggles?
Yes, everyone jokes that she's me in the female version. She's my mini me. So all my good traits are there. All my bad traits are there. Abraham, everything comes easy to him, my oldest. And I already see my youngest. Everything already comes easy to both of them. Her, she has to struggle, but I think she's the most creative and flexible as well.
Adaptable.
Adaptable, which we mentioned earlier as well.
Yeah.
Flexibility and adaptability. Yeah.
You think that's a result in part because she's had to struggle a little more than the boys?
Oh, definitely. Definitely so. But she's also my most strong-willed child as well. And that's a challenge in itself as well.
Yeah, sure. So you've walked us through a bunch of different examples of where you've had to pivot, be adaptable, be resilient, be anti-fragile, whatever it might be. Personal life, social life, right? We've pulled out some really great themes, I think, around that being sort of a we experience or we endeavor. We've talked a little bit about how you think about applying that to parenting and letting certain things happen or putting your kids in situations where they need to maybe safely struggle a bit, right, with some support behind them. We always ask our guests to think about sort of the one thing, maybe not the one thing, but a thing that's sort of most central and foundational to their ability to, you know, flourish, or in this case, be anti-fragile. And I'm curious what that, you know, kind of most core foundational thing would be for you. And if you have kind of closing thoughts for our listeners on how they might get started with cultivating that one thing potentially for themselves.
I think you and I, we've talked about it in the past where everyone's different. Sure. And everyone has different goals and whatnot. For me, I guess the primary word is probably being integrity and trying to do things the right way and back to the community. If you do not have trust, you can't have community. If no one trusts you, you can't have friends. as a former business owner and current business owner as well, if your customers don't have trust in you, you don't have any business, you don't have any trust. And so it's cultivating that trust and building those relationships to, I guess, flourish, whether it be spousal. If my spouse doesn't trust me, then I'm not going to have a great relationship. If my children don't trust me, I'm not going to have a relationship with them. I want to have a relationship with them in 30 years when they start having kids and whatnot. I want them to be around. So I'm trying to do all the stuff that's necessary, like building that foundation so that way they want to come back. And then friends, customers, whatever it's whatever entails, is like have that trustworthiness. And if you want, we've talked about this in the past. My favorite group is Outkast. If you're like everyone else, if you act like everyone else, you're going to be like everyone else. It's okay to be different. And that's why I tell my kids, it's all right to be different. Do your thing. And you'll actually see the results from that. And the other thing is, like Jesus said, if you walk with a man 1 mile, walk with him two. Try to be, if someone asks you to be a friend, be the friend that you would want in those situations.
Yeah. It's a great, I think, way of tying everything together. Because again, a lot of what you've brought up today, I think, has some sort of outside in or social or interpersonal element to it. And what you've said is invest in relationships. And what's one of the best ways to invest in relationships? Have integrity. Approach it the way you think it needs to be approached to do right by others, build that trust, et cetera. Right. It's perfect. Love it. So our listeners probably don't know, we didn't necessarily get to it, but obviously the trucking company Advanced, you very recently exited, and now you're off to some new endeavors, some different businesses, and some things you're excited about. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find out more information about you and your business or interact with you further?
Okay. Yes. Back in May, we sold our trucking company, and I thought I was going to be able to do the transition with the new ownership, but I quickly realized that it wasn't for me. And as I was trying to decide what to do next, back to what you're saying, trying to be flexible, I'm going to try to wrap this up real fast. We had AI in our cameras, artificial intelligence in our cameras, and it helped lower our safety scores for the trucking company and our insurance costs. Well, also with the advent of ChatGPT back in last October, I decided to create a tutor for my daughter who has dyslexia and see if we could create a tutor to help her learn subjects, because I'm not a good teacher. I'm a great coach, but not a good teacher. But I was able to create a tutor for her. And I started thinking, like, with artificial intelligence, no one knows what it is. That means I want to learn as much as I can about it and see maybe if I can implement it within small businesses and organizations. So I decided to leave the company and start up an artificial intelligence consulting company. I was taking some classes through MIT, and now we're actually creating consulting small businesses about artificial intelligence, what it is, what it's not, and different ways they can implement it within their businesses and create different solutions for them as well.
Yeah, great. So where can people get in touch with you or find out more about you and or the company?
Okay, well, you can find me on LinkedIn, or you can also go to LinkedIn at Answers Infinite AI Consulting, or you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or answersinfinite.com.
Cool. Great. Awesome. Josh, this was a real pleasure. Very much appreciative of the time it took from, you know, it's a very busy life for you, obviously, as a family guy and a professional as well. So thanks for sharing the time with us. Thanks for sharing your insights. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Flourish FM. We hope you enjoyed the content. Please be sure to leave us a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast and on all major social media platforms.
And if you visit our website, flourishfmpodcast.com, you can sign up to our newsletter. We send out a weekly newsletter, first newsletter of every month. We share a long form blog, and every newsletter, every week, we share highlights from our previous episodes. Please hit subscribe on our website.